All right, we're gonna get started. Just a quick reminder to silence your phone.
Something's happening. You're gonna speak. Have we got a sound man upstairs?
Testing.
Testing.
Are these things working?
Hello, hello. Is that working?
No.
Okay, let me find the soundboard.
Right. Start talking loudly. Just carry on talking loudly.
All right, just a quick reminder to silence your phones before we begin. And then this room does not use the CWA app. So if you do have any questions, we're going to be using a note card system for today. So just raise your hand at any time if you have a question. Our producer will come over and hand you a note card and pencil and write down your question, and then we will take those at the end. Oh, we're in. All right, today's date is Friday, April 14th, 2017. The time is 3 p.m. The panel number is 5706, and it is titled, AI May Not Kill Our Jobs, But It Will Change Many. My name is Daniel Atkins, and I'm an undergraduate here in electrical engineering. And we have two lovely panelists with us today. We have Roger Walton to my left. He graduated with an electronics engineering degree from Liverpool, and he specializes in automation and data management and movement, and he currently works at Warespace. And then to his left, we have Danielle Osler, who is a public policy consultant at Google currently. She also got an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering from the University of Illinois. She got her master's in public policy at Princeton, and she also completed Harvard Law School. And without further ado, we'll have the panelists introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about what they do, how they got into these positions, and a little bit about AI and automation.
Well, hello. I don't know if you've noticed, but this is a very special room. We are actually in the Matrix. So this is going to be a test to see whether you think we're real or not. So if I start to pixelate, you'll know that I might not be real. Actually, a fascinating building, isn't it? It's great. So automation software, or automation, as opposed. I mean, I work around automation. So automation and AI. I think it's worth... Well, first of all, I have a passion for both understanding the business and social implications of what automation and AI can do for humanity. I'm very keen on it. I think it's wonderful. I think, I've been on a couple of panels this week, and some of them have touched on the subject, and I believe we're at the point of a fourth industrial revolution. I think it is going to have the most dramatic impact on our lives. It's going to have a dramatic impact on our working lives. It's going to have a dramatic impact on our personal lives. And I think we have a fantastic opportunity to make it really work for us. My nervousness is that we're not doing anything to make sure that that's the case. So if you think back to what I said about the social implication of this, I think it is absolutely paramount that we start preparing, starting in ready for the implications of that. I think it's worth just sort of making a differentiation between, I know this particular lecture is about AI. I don't think AI in our sort of super futuristic understanding of what AI might be is here yet. I think we're still working on that. There is really a lot of very clever automation. And I think if you look at the applications of this automation, yes, there is some intelligence with it, but it's not intelligence as we see ourselves as being intelligent. I was on a panel yesterday talking about singularity and is the real world going to turn into Westworld? I'm not sure that's going to happen perhaps in our lifetime, but it's going to start to get close. And the big difference to that is there is no sense of consciousness around the software. It doesn't have this idea of what is actually going on around it and the reasons why things are going on around it. Yes, it can have targets, it can have specific missions, it can have things that it's got to do, it can have efficiencies. There's all sorts of wonderful things that it can do. But is it going to replace the human mind? Not in any short space of time, but I think we need to be prepared that it's going to have a lot of power and it's going to have a lot of implications about what we do. So for me, it's fascinating technology, it's a fascinating time. I think we've got a wonderful opportunity for the first time, I think, in the various industrial revolutions that we've had, to really make this all work for humans and not just look at ways of oh, we're just going to make things more efficient, we're going to cut jobs, we're going to cut prices, we're going to make more money, we're going to do this. We have a fantastic opportunity to make humanity a much better environment and a much better place for us to live in. So I'm looking forward to the debate, I'm looking forward to the chatting with the panellists, and looking forward to your questions. So let's get going. But let me hand over to Danielle first. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, and appreciate your taking the time on this lovely Friday afternoon to be here to discuss this fascinating topic. My name is Danielle Oetzler, and as Daniel mentioned, I am a public policy counsel at Google. And so I am an electrical engineer and a lawyer, which means I'm probably not that great at either one of those. What I do is I sit with the product groups in Mountain View and help think through how particular features might be perceived by both the public or policymakers in a broader context of how we're thinking about both, you know, privacy and security and data management and everything to just how does this product feel. So that's my contribution there. I will say that I lived in Colorado for several years. I still technically live here, although I work in Mountain View, right in Highlands Ranch. So I'm particularly happy to be here today. I think obviously this is really a topic that is in the news. It's highlighted from not only events but just it's in the zeitgeist for whatever reason. And so I think it's really important for us to engage on it. And like Roger said, not just engage on the kind of the hyperbolic ideas of what might happen with artificial intelligence and machine learning, but to really look at what's happening now and how we can engage with it. I think if you get too hyperbolic, you start to think about things that aren't actually really possible, and then you start crafting either policy solutions that are not addressing the real world or are overreactive to some of the real benefits that machine learning has to offer. So I think I'll just mention quickly, I very much agree with your point about the difference between machine learning and artificial intelligence. And at Google, we really put machine learning into play every day. And if I could have a moment or two just to talk about some of the examples of that, maybe that you are aware of or maybe not so aware of. But most people have, for example, Gmail. And you might have noticed if you've had it for a while that you get a lot less spam than you used to. Man, you used to get so much spam. And now, only every once in a while, just a few things slip through. And that's because we have machine learning. Normally, it used to be that you would just add to an ever-growing list of spammers, and they would then, you know, change where they're sending it from or change a couple of words, and then it was a totally new thing that had to be flagged and then put in a database and referenced. But now machines can understand what it means to be a spammy email and keep that out of your inbox before you even see it. And that's a huge benefit that's, you know, saves so much time from just an economic perspective. And there's also some real potential in some of the things that machine learning might be able to resolve. So for example, diabetic retinopathy is a disease that you have. Your retina is degenerative, you have diabetes. This is something that takes a doctor and an expert to sort of diagnose. It's particularly difficult to diagnose if you're you know, someplace remote where you don't have access to medical care. And so if you catch it early, you can actually reverse this process. If you don't catch it, then you may be blind. So one of the things that we've been able to do is teach machines how to read these various scans so that they can see immediately if someone might have the potential for diabetic retinopathy, and then give that information to doctors so they can do an additional assessment and get people the treatment they need. And you know, there are just an infinite number of potential applications for this kind of work. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind when we think about some of the pitfalls and the problems that may occur with machine learning becoming more ubiquitous in our society.
Thank you very much. So kind of moving forward with the fourth industrial revolution, you mentioned that we may not be taking some of the proper steps needed to fully benefit from this. What would some of those steps look like to really benefit from it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think, let me take a step back and sort of, you know, throw out some of the facts that I've picked up over the last few years in terms of the impact of jobs and what that might mean, and then I'll talk about what I think could be done about it. You know, blue-collar workers, whatever that means, but you know, it's pretty well understood. They've seen a massive impact on automation, machinery, software that can do things differently, robots that can kind of take some of those functions away. And you've seen a decimation of a lot of manufacturing, traditional manufacturing type jobs. And I think we've all come to accept that, and I think we've all come to accept that it's going to get even more so. What is particularly interesting is the opportunity now that white-collar workers are facing of having so many parts of their functions and their jobs and their roles potentially being replaced by some degree of automation or some degree of intelligence, some degree of robotics. So, you know, I think that's going to have a dramatic impact, and that's going to have much more of a social impact, and I'm not going to get into the reasons why, but we all know that perhaps there's a bit more vocal effects that we hear about in the white-collar community than perhaps we do in the blue-collar community. So we're going to hear a lot more about it, and there's going to be a lot more frustration, there's going to be a lot more fear, and there's going to be a lot more people that are very, very disappointed and very upset about the implications of that. So it's going to become much more in the public domain. And I'm concerned that there is very little that all governments, and I'm not just talking about here in the US, but all around the world, that they're not doing enough to figure out, well, what is going to happen? What is actually going to happen if we do see 600 million jobs disappear in China? 600 million jobs in China. eBay, they're using software now, instead of lawyers, to satisfy something like $50 million worth of disputes without any human intervention. There are many, many organisations. You know, we've heard about some of the medical advances. Automated blood testing that's so cost effective that you'll be able to have a full diagnosis of potential disease that you might have from a single blood test that currently you don't necessarily have and you don't necessarily do. What's the impact on the medical community? So I think whilst there's all these things sound wonderful and great, but they also sound really scary, what are we going to do about, well, if these jobs do go away, what are the people that perhaps lose their jobs, what are they going to be doing? And I think if you go back 30 years, maybe even a bit longer, and see some of the Reagan and from my country, the Thatcher policies, to say, look, we need to get away from low-cost manufacturing, we need to get into the service community, we need to do more because there's more money and more revenue associated with that, a fine strategy in terms of moving the economy. But what was done for the people that lost their jobs and their communities? What was done for the steel workers, for the miners, for the car manufacturers, what was actually done to give them an alternative? And I think we're now starting to see some of the frustrations and the effects of people realising now, or actually sort of coming to the fore saying, look, we've lost our purpose in life. You know, you can't just take me from a history of my family in the mining and the steelworking community and expect me to go and work in Walmart. It doesn't, you know, I don't get the same satisfaction, I don't get the same sense of purpose. So I think, back to your question, we've got to look at this real, real scary social impact and figure out, well, how do we retrain people? How do we offer other alternative career paths for people? How do we retrain the children of these people that potentially we're replacing so we don't get that second generation effect? And what are the kinds of things that we're doing? What are the kinds of things that we're educating around? I mean, if you look at what AI and what automation can do, it's going to take a lot of the sort of drudgery tasks away from white-collar workers. And those particular tasks might be knowledge-based, they might be facts-based. And if you think about what are we teaching our children to counter that, we're stuffing their heads full of knowledge again, which is, if you really think about it, knowledge is easy to acquire, or relatively easy to acquire. You've got to teach people how to make use of that knowledge, how to analyse that knowledge, how to apply that knowledge. And those are the skills that we should be teaching and we should be thinking about, because those are the skills that are going to be needed when we start to replace those mundane tasks and those mundane repetitive things that people are doing. So do you see my point? It's a really exciting time, and we're going to have so many things that are taken away from us that are boring, but we've got to find the other things to do. I read one report where something like 40-odd% of the mundane tasks can be replaced. Well, there's still 53% of other things that need focus on. So let's get people working in that. Let's train people to address that. So I think the first thing is to look at how we train and how we educate and how we prepare people. And then I think the second thing is, what are we doing to ensure that the application of all this technology is sensible, realistic, and safe? Because let's face it, there is a lot of power in this technology, and it could be used in the wrong way. So who is going to own this technology? Who is going to have access to it? And how is it going to be extended? So I think there's a lot that governments can do, and I think we live in an age now where regulation is a bad word, and it's, no, leave it to the free markets. Well, I don't think you can in this instance. We have to have very coordinated and very global agreements about how we make the most of this technology in a safe way and ensure that we're protected from both a social impact and a potential threat and risk to our well-being as well.
Did you have any comments on any of that?
Well, there was quite a lot there.
Sorry.
I will say I think it's helpful to put some of it into both a historic perspective and then just the perspective of what's happening on the ground right now. So, I mean, obviously we've been dealing with economic dislocation due to trade or technological innovation ever since the Industrial Revolution happened and Luddites rose up to say that they did not want textile workers' jobs to be replaced in that way. So we have to consistently recognize that this is a real serious issue, but that these kind of fears about technology have, for the most part, been largely unfounded. I think we could agree that our standard of living has grown from every point in the world quite significantly over the past 100 years due to a lot of technological innovation. Now, certainly there is, unforeseen consequences to some of the technological advances that we've had, but there's been real progress. Everything from vaccination to electrical distribution. There's a whole lot of great things that have happened because of technological advancement. Now, I think that machine learning and artificial intelligence, such as it is particularly concerning because of the pace that we've seen it grow. But we have to also recognize that machine learning and these concepts have been around for at least 50 years. We've been thinking about these things and developing them for quite a long time, and they've been integrated into a lot of products and ways that you go about seeing your world for quite a while. We just, it doesn't necessarily hasn't come to the forefront of our minds. And I think that you're exactly right. Part of it is because it's not just blue collar workers that are being displaced, but lawyers. I remember when I was at a law firm, the drudgery of just having to just mark whether or not a document was privileged or not, and you just do this with thousands and thousands of documents, and now something can automate that. That's great. I mean, I would like to think that my worth and the worth to the client of, whatever, $100 an hour they were charging them would be better for me to be thinking about how to resolve a dispute rather than just categorizing documents day to day. So I do think that even in industries where it seems like they will clearly be displaced, for example, ATMs displacing bank tellers, that actually hasn't come to pass. There are actually more bank tellers now than there were before ATMs existed. And that's because you can reinvest that money, and people do like an actual human touch when they're banking, and there's more sophisticated things you can do than just what your ATM does. So even for the near-term jobs that we think are clearly going to go away because of automation, it's not necessarily the case that those specific jobs are going to go away. But I think your point is very valid. We do need to start thinking, and some governments are more thoughtful about this than others, in my experience, about how we prepare for automation. It's difficult because I don't even think experts agree to how much it's going to affect particular jobs. I've seen everywhere from 10% of jobs will be impacted by automation to 50% of jobs will be impacted. That's a huge difference and would really change how you would view policy based on which one of those are right. We cannot predict the future, we don't know, but it's something that people should be aware of when they're thinking about how to craft public policy. And also, what is that impact? Is it minor? Is it freeing people up? Is it a change and a shift about where people spend their time? Is it a shift from services? Does it mean we need a lot more education, or do we just need education in different places? These are very difficult things to know at this point in time. So I think that's just another reason why it's so difficult for governments and other interested parties to engage in this. But I think there are some things that we can definitely say that we should do. For example, one is a further investment in education, a real commitment to education across the board, and one that is also technologically sound. I mean, people should know a lot more about the world that they're operating in and how to manipulate machines as they come forward. I think that everyone should learn to code they should understand these things. Even if you're not going to be a coder, it informs how you're viewing the world, how you can see what these possibilities and threats are. So I think that's one thing we should certainly do. Another thing that we can do, and Google works a lot to do also, is to empower entrepreneurs. So a lot more of us are going to be starting our own businesses, engaged in service providing that machines or automation just cannot possibly do. And we need to make sure that people can make those transitions in a way that allows them to flourish rather than be worried that there's no safety net. I remember when I left a job that I had, and I was like, well, maybe I'll start my own business. And the main thing I thought to myself was, am I going to have healthcare for my daughter? Like, how do I actually make that work? And actually, the realization that Colorado expanded Medicare and I could go on that for a short period of time while I started my business was really great. That was really helpful for me. And when we start to think about that, like, there'll be times when people are changing jobs, where there'll be dislocation, where they're getting new education to work in the 21st century, 22nd century and beyond, that we provide a stable safety net for them. That would be really incredible. And I think we just need to think more broadly about the fact that we're not powerless in this world. We have the capability to decide where we're going to automate certain things and where we're not. If you decide that, your doctor coming in to visit your doctor, you don't want to have an automated greeter at the door, you can say, I'm not going to do that. We can decide as a broader society what parts of industry or interactions between humans and machines that we really want to have and we want to support, or ones that we don't want to support. And so I want people to not feel like they are just subject to these whims of technology, but that they can really be engaged and empowered on these issues.
Yeah, I mean, just one more thing to add to support. I completely agree. I read a fact. I read an opinion the other day, and it said that they estimated in the U.S. that 25% of 18 to 24-year-old males drive something for a living, which is amazing. And you think all of those jobs are going to go away, because all of those jobs that they're doing typically are driving vans, they're driving taxis, they're driving delivery vehicles and so forth. They're all going to be automated within the next 10 to 15 years. So that is a lot of people. In the US, there is something like, in fact, I've got the number here, it's several hundred thousand people working on checkout counters in supermarkets. All those jobs are going to go away. You know, we've seen what Amazon have got with the completely automated supermarket in Seattle, where you just drive the cart out of the store and everything's get bills to your credit card. Those jobs are going to go. What are we going to do with those people to help them to find things around it? I think with the white-collar workers, there's going to be plenty that people will do around that. Your example of the lawyers kind of checking off the validation of documents. There are many, many other things that you're going to be able to do around that function. We're in supermarkets, as drivers, what are those things? And that's what I think we need to really focus on. And it's those kind of swathes of society that I think are really going to struggle. I like to consider myself, by the way, as a neo-Luddite.
Well, I like to consider myself an optimist. I really do. I think that the jury is still out about what those people will do if those jobs go away. So, I mean, you think about the millions of jobs that exist now that couldn't possibly have existed 10 years ago, even. I mean, if you're a social media maven, you couldn't do that before. People are making livelihoods on YouTube. They make content that people want to see. People advertise against that, and they get paid. You know, there are a lot of different things that, the whole world were in which, you would go to work and then come home and take a shower. Now you go to shower before you go to work. These are a whole plethora of things that even a generation ago we wouldn't have thought about. And so I think it's important to remember that we cannot predict what will be. And I know that there's a fear, but I have to imagine in the mind of every truck driver, there's also the heart of like an artist or a musician, and hopefully if we can automate the mundane tasks and give them space to do more creative things, people will have, more disposable income, and they can do things like go see concerts or go have a drink, and bartenders can get paid, or they can have, barbershops flourish. There are a lot of different things that you wouldn't even need a lot of, technical education and skill to have. You might need a lot of skill and a lot of marketing savvy to be able to do. But I think that there is a way that there's a transition. It's just really hard to see.
Another question I was wondering is, right now, what do you see as the next kind of forefront of automation that's going to have the biggest impact in the world in terms of social impacts on people?
Vehicle automation. That's the one that's looming, that's the one that's hot right now. We've all seen examples of Tesla cars, some of them driving safely, some of them not so. But that's the bit that's looming, that's here. I mean, I drive a very safe Swedish Volvo, and it's got one of these adaptive cruise controls where you set your speed and you set the distance in front of the car in front of you, and you don't have to touch the brakes. I mean, literally, this car will stop if the cars in front of you stop, and it will then accelerate again if the cars in front of you accelerate again. You just have to hold the wheel. So, which is great. It's hard to trust, but it's pretty good. That's just one tiny aspect of the automation that's going to come, and literally you will be sitting in that vehicle and you won't have to touch anything. Or you'll be sitting in the back of a vehicle which is an automated cab. And that is all imminent. That is going to be within the next 10 to 15 years. And I think that's going to be the first thing that is wonderful, but it's the first thing that's going to be really frightening, because I am an optimist too, by the way, with this technology, but those drivers, those 18 to 24-year-olds that perhaps didn't pay attention at school, they didn't quite get the right or good enough qualification, what are they going to do? And how do we help them find these other roles and jobs? Yeah, there might be artists, there might be musicians, but they don't know how to make money from that right now. And that's my concern, is that we can't just leave them on the side of the road. Excuse my pun. But you've got to do something with them. Otherwise, we're going to have serious social disorder, because there's a lot of people that are going to be displaced and very frustrated.
Right, I mean, I think we're seeing the frustration and displacement now, at least in our domestic politics. Some of the ramifications of that are really clear. To your point about what might be a cool frontier, I really think it's in medicine, not only in diagnoses and being able to allow that expertise to be automated so that you can get into the system a lot more quickly, like my diabetic retinopathy example. But also personalized medicine, the idea that you could take all of the information from your genome and your history and your experiences, and you could have a very specific and targeted health intervention that could really help you. That is not going to be able to be done except for with machine learning that can process through all of the amounts of data and all of the kind of particular details of your own life and tailor something to you and understand what those outcomes are, and then use that information again, feeding it into the system to be able to have better and better outcomes, and to not only have better outcomes, but to spread the benefits of those outcomes across the world by making it less expensive, by making people be able to do these things remotely, and to just generally bring down the cost for everyone. So I think there's a lot of really exciting opportunities, and we do need to engage on what will we do with people who are displaced, There's just so many potential benefits. I think we should keep that in the forefront of our minds when we're thinking about, how should we regulate these areas? What should we do? When should we intervene to stop the growth of machine learning in various areas?
I'm actually going to start taking a few audience questions as well, just like a few of these. So how do we spread the wealth from increased automation and make sure there's not a financial gap between those who are really benefiting from the automation, those who maybe own companies which have thousands of engineers writing the software, and people who are working kind of less automated, or who are being replaced by these automated jobs?
I've seen a number of different sort of thoughts around this, and one of the ones, well, probably a couple of ones I'll touch on. The first is to look at what, and I'm talking really here about specific technology, automation that is displacing jobs, rather than just technological advances that make everything better, which is wonderful and great. So if you look at a function, whether it's a robot or whether it's a piece of technology or a piece of software that replaces all or part of a significant part of a role and a job, therefore you displace people, you should have a tax on that technology. And that tax on technology can help with the retraining, with the reapplication of those people, finding other things for them to do, helping them into different parts of the workforce. And maybe even extend to, there are several different trials of this going on right now, some in Europe, there's discussion about it being trialed in California as well, which is for a universal basic income. I don't know if everybody knows what a universal basic income or the philosophy behind that. I think a lot of people go, oh, that's it, it's communism, it's taking over the world and it's going to destroy the country. Well, it's not really. It's basically just doing away with welfare completely and just saying to every single person, you get a basic income. So we make everything more efficient and we give the individuals a degree of money that allows them to take up their hobbies, maybe pursue things in music or arts or retraining or restudying or so, or what it might ever be. Or they might just want to sit there and not do anything. But so be it. You can't change that. But if you apply that and you use this, and this is the bit that I get excited about, because this is what could create a wonderful shift in humanity for us if we do this sensibly. And we don't make it out that it's just some big tax that's going to, you know, destroy entrepreneurialism and invention and capitalism, but it's actually helping humanity to have a better role in what they're doing in their lives. So I think there's a lot that can be done to provision for that, but again, we have to have the right attitude and the right will to do that.
So just to the universal basic income point, I think it's an intriguing idea. And I think, in fact, Nixon had thought about this idea in the United States context, which is not what you normally associate with communism. I think it's hard to figure out if that makes sense when it's really difficult to tell, even from economic and expert opinion, how many jobs are going to be displaced and what that displacement kind of looks like. So it's hard to imagine how that would, frankly, be debated in our current context. But I think it's something that we should look at, and I think it gets to the fundamental point about needing a safety net that makes sense and that will allow people to weather the displacement. I think that there's another issue with respect to that you alluded to a bit earlier, which is, you know, how do you... People want to feel valued in their society. You don't want to just have a job so you can make money. You want to have a job so you feel like you're part of a collective society, that your contributions are worthwhile. Particularly in the United States context, we get a lot of, you know, social esteem from the jobs that we have. So I don't think we just need to look at it from, like, how do we make sure people stay having money? We need to figure out how do we show that we value people in society. And that is not a question that, like, technologists can answer. That is something that society has to answer. We have to think about very deeply. Just the specific question about how do we make sure that we share the wealth. I think if you look at it from just a more purely sort of technological perspective, like how do you make sure that one company doesn't just have all of the knowledge and ability to automate things. I mean, Google has worked very collaboratively in the area of machine learning. So we have a few tools that are open source that anyone can use, and if they wanted to develop or build kind of a machine learning program, or they want to do some analysis with machine learning. One is called TensorFlow, and it's in use right now with researchers. And even our Google Cloud products allow you to use machine learning APIs that you can incorporate into the products you develop. And I think that will really, because it's open source, that will really allow a broad range of people to apply these to the problems that they want to solve. For example, I think that one of the coolest examples I saw of this is a farmer in Japan who was growing cucumbers and wanted to find, kind of automate the boring task of, like, having his mom like sort the good cucumbers for the bad. So he can use TensorFlow, and, like, because he also had a little bit of coding experience and knowledge and did a little schooling, he's actually able to automate, like, a cucumber sorting machine just on his family farm, right? So he's making life better for himself. And that's with open source tools. So I think that we want to encourage people to find ways that are both open source and interoperable and share the information and the wealth and the real potential that machine learning has across our economy.
But I completely agree. I think you're absolutely right. It's not just about taking those drivers and finding them something else to do that's equally mundane. It's giving them the opportunity to do something much more interesting. I completely agree. And that's the opportunity we have if we do it right.
Another question I was wondering about is, so the world's population is increasing faster and faster, and the rate of automation is increasing faster and faster, and generally, even though automation can create jobs, you tend to lose jobs. How do we deal with this kind of dilemma of there's more people, but less work to do?
Well, there's still several billion people, you know, that don't have access to running water and living on a few bucks a day. So I think there's a huge amount that we can do to improve their lives and share our technology and our advancements in healthcare and everything else that that we've done. So the growth to facilitate better lives for those that that don't have it is phenomenal. And so, you know, that's the one thing we can do is to, and it's not just about giving things to them. It's sharing our know-how, sharing our technology, sharing our advancements, and applying it into these growth economies where, you know, again, if we do this right, we can actually make money and make it viable, make it commercially viable, so that everybody's lives improve. But again, we have to have a collective effort and a collective will to be able to do that, to share these technologies.
Yeah, you know, I think it's difficult because, you know, none of us can predict the future, but also, I mean, we have a lens of our own, our community and society, when we think about what problems need to be solved and where the opportunities are, especially from an entrepreneurial perspective. You know, we try very hard to invest in entrepreneurs across the world. A lot of them are sort of tech entrepreneurs that we try to invest in. But I think if we think more about what are the problems that need to be solved, exactly like you said, not only from just a basic livelihood perspective, but there are just so many problems that need to be solved and that actually can be monetized to be solved, right? Like there are ways in which you know, people are investing in the developing world, for example, in trying to get clean water, but they're not just doing it simply as a charity, but you know, as social entrepreneurship, right? There are a lot of different models and modes. If we spend more time investing in people and not imagining that we have the answer for them, but that if you give people the tools, then they actually can solve their own problems, I think that's one of the things we need to do. We just have so much of the knowledge and capital in one spot, it's going to be very hard to imagine how we can address that. But if we try to find systematic ways, if it's not from the government, but from our own communities and from our own more creative ways of approaching that, from industry, we should be engaged on this too. And I think that we can kind of get ahead of this vicious cycle of you know, automation taking over as more and more people come into being.
Another question is, so who exactly is going to be supporting this regulation of how fast we automate, or who the benefits go to? And since a lot of it is seems to be driven by, you know, profit margins on big companies, you know, who decides and who's going to back what steps we take forward to make sure that this has a positive effect on our culture and not negative ones?
Wow. Well, it's all of us. It's all of us. We have to create that change. I mean, we've all heard of the World Economic Forum in Davos. In 2010, they calculated that 43 people had as much money as the 50% of the poorest people. Last year, that reduced to 8 people. 8 people has as much money as 50% of the poorest people on the planet. It's unsustainable. It's absolutely unsustainable, and that's the kind of thing that has to change. Because what might happen is those 8 people grab all of the technology, grab all of the automation technique, grab all of those industries that can be created with more efficiencies, and become even richer. So we have to change it. You know, and this isn't just a, you know, fist thumping, let's go out and kind of with our pitchforks and torches and change the world, but we are the people that can force that change. Look what's happened in a few elections and referendums in the last year or so here in terms of Brexit and our friend Mr. Trump. Whichever side you're on, they have been dramatic change. The people have voted because they wanted something different. And we have that power and we have that ability, and that's what we have to do, is to change it. So who owns it and who is responsible for it? It is the governments. Those are the people that have the power and the regulation to create the change. But we have to get them to change too. We have to drive them to make sure that this technology is not abused. And I keep coming back to, I'm not talking about technological advancements that make our lives better. Those are all fantastic and fabulous. It is about the automation that is replacing jobs. That's the big concern. This is going to have a big impact on millions and millions of people. And if we don't do it right, it's just going to get worse. We're going to end up with one person with as much money as the last 50% on the planet. So we have to get our governments to be responsible and make it more effective and make it fairer and make it more accessible.
You know, it's hard to know where to start with that question. I do think that people should be more engaged on this issue, but I think it's actually not necessarily clear what particular automations are creating more jobs and which ones are creating less. So in the situation where you have an ATM, for example, but now there are more bank tellers, you wouldn't have predicted that ahead of time. So if you were to tax that, then none of us would have the benefit of ATMs, and we'd actually have fewer jobs. So we have to be very conscious and thoughtful about how we sort of motivate particular innovation in that area. I think one thing that we can do is enable more people to take advantage of those and not just have it be corporate oriented. It doesn't have to be that at all. I also think that there are subtle changes that happen in the policy world that we don't necessarily think about that are influencing how jobs are distributed that we're not really necessarily engaged on because, you know, most people don't have the time or the inclination or expertise to be able to parse through everything that's happening. And if you look at like sort of the consolidation of companies over time and how that has affected workers, right? We could say to ourselves that we want to be, you know, more forward-leaning on antitrust or on allowing companies to conglomerate, right? But we haven't necessarily put ourselves out there to say that that is a problem because it's hard to see in an amorphous world like what the impacts are. I think we can see now that local businesses aren't necessarily doing as well as they would otherwise if there weren't some of this deregulation that happened in that space. But we have to think of it holistically. We have to think to ourselves, what do we want society to look like? And then what are the levers that we can pull to make that happen? And I don't know if we've engaged a lot on what we want our society to look like. You know, I think we often feel like viscerally that, you know, economic inequality is not that great. And we see now that it could have potential political effects. But like, how do we really feel like that from a moral perspective? Like, and then what do you do to influence your policymakers or your companies? Don't buy things from people that don't have your values. I think that's a completely legitimate way to engage. And so it's hard to answer because the answer is from a broad collective, right? Like we all need to be more engaged. We need to hold large companies accountable. We need to make sure that we are investing. I think those are all things that are true, and we can't be distracted by some of the divisions that are happening currently, and at least in our American politics, to stop us from really saying, this is what we care about, fix this problem, engage on this issue.
Yep. And then kind of taking back, turning towards the educational system, you know, how confident are you that the current public education system in the United States is able to accommodate kind of these changes that are needed to retrain people and get them into entrepreneurial positions and move away from just kind of knowledge factories and more towards areas that develop critical thinking where they can create their own business and ideas?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, really good question. And I was talking with somebody last night about, I'm staying with a guest here in Boulder, and they were saying that they're finding it extraordinarily hard to find tradespeople, in the Colorado, in the Boulder area. Very difficult to find a plumber, very difficult to find a good carpenter to kind of help them with their home improvements. These jobs, by the way, are not going to be the ones that are going to be replaced by automation. It's just not cost effective to do that. You know, you've got to make a highly sophisticated robot to figure out how to do plumbing. It's just not worth it. It's easier to replace a clerical job with technology than it is a plumber. So why don't we encourage people to do plumbing? Why is it still considered as a sort of a lowly type trade role when actually it's extraordinarily valuable and it changes, it actually really does contribute to people's lives. When I've had leaks before, I can tell you it doesn't make for very pleasant living. So we have an opportunity to kind of take the stigma perhaps out of some vocational roles I think if you look at Germany, they have a fabulous education system where they will educate, you know, the smart for higher value or higher kind of academic orientated degrees, but they have a very, very good vocational education system too. And that's why there's such a very strong engineering company community in Germany, and they're suffering less from some of the fallouts of these economies over the last few years. So why can't we do that? Why don't we look at not just the kind of core education, but applying more investment and more encouragement for vocational type roles? But going back to the core education, again, it's what I was saying before. It's you've got to have the knowledge. I'm not saying knowledge is irrelevant, but it's the more important skills are around the application of their knowledge, around critical thinking, around analysis. You know, we're going to see ridiculous amounts of data come from some of these automation techniques, like car automation, like the Internet of Things, where we monitor everything. How do you analyse that data? What are you going to do with that? Those are the kind of functions that are going to be much more important in the future. And it's those countries that are looking at the future as to what is important in education for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years that are going to start to be the leaders in the world's economy. And I have to say, and the UK, where I'm from, they're not investing in the right way. And I don't think it's happening as much here in the US as perhaps we could be.
You know, I think when we think about education, we think that, one, it should be sort of tech-based or STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. And I think that that's very true. But we also just need to invest in people in a more fundamental way. And I say that because I always wanted to be an engineer. I always, as soon as I knew what it was, I thought it was great. And it wasn't that people didn't say that I didn't have necessarily the opportunity to study that. I just didn't necessarily have the support and know all the details necessary to get me to where I am, right? Like, to get all the way from, like, I think science is cool, which lots of kids do, lots of women do, lots of underrepresented minorities do. It's totally different from saying, how do you actually get to that degree point? And we need to think more about how to support people all the way through that. And I'll just say briefly, I think Colorado is really moving forward as a leader in the how do we change the way we think about technical education from a sort of non-university degree perspective, both with more choices from the high school perspective, and stackable credits that people are thinking about here, and moving in and out. Maybe you start out as an electrician and then you go get an electrical engineering degree because that's interesting to you. Or maybe you can move through apprenticeships and get the information and skills that you need to. So just breaking down that we really need those people to be engaged on lots of different fronts, and that they need to be supported because the process is really hard to figure out if you're not already in it. I think that we really have the potential to broaden the scope and actually address some of these things. I mean, we have hundreds of thousands of software engineers and cybersecurity professionals that are not filled every year. Those positions are not filled because we don't have the ability to get people who are interested in them to where they need to go. So we need to make sure that we can support people along the path and not assume that they don't want to do it or they're not engaged, but that they just need the resources to do it.
All right. How do you see some of the effects of automation changing both the United States' economy and some of the interactions between countries? Do you see that as being a big change as some automate more and more and some don't?
Well, absolutely. Again, I think this comes down to the right balance again, doesn't it? There's obviously going to be significant investment in automation here in the US and generally in the Western economies. We talked about car automation, we talked about, you know, retail automation and so forth. And some of the kind of the growing economies are going to have less of that. But what will be really interesting is, as I said before, who is investing into the right kind of roles, the right kind of education for the future that can provide or provision for that change? You know, there could be a very dramatic short-term gain in automating a lot of roles, a lot of functions, but what happens in the long term? And it's those organisations that are really thinking smartly about what's going to happen next that may well actually then overtake and sort of displace some of the leaders in applying of this technology right now. So right now, I think there's a lot of incentive for the organisations that are using the technology to win and to economically win out of that. what are we, or the governments, doing to help facilitate more collaboration and more sharing of ideas and more sharing of how do we regulate, how do we provision for this? What are we doing in the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years? I mean, there was an AI conference in, I think it was in Puerto Rico in 2015, and they asked all of the, these are the world leaders in AI, at what point do we think singularity? And singularity is when you've developed technology that starts to take over the learning itself, so it becomes independent with its ability to learn. And at what point do we think singularity is going to occur? And most people said within the next 30 to 40 years. And that's terrifying, you know, because we're not ready for it. I mean, it's wonderfully exciting because this technology is going to be so powerful for us, but it's terrifying that we're not being thinking about preparing for it right now. So I think it's got to have better collaboration and better sharing of so many things across the globe. And hopefully we can learn from those that are educating their youngsters in a better way, and they can learn from some of the techniques that we're applying.
I think you are starting to see governments and even municipalities recognizing that this is kind of a new area of potential competition and real competitive advantage that they might have, right? Like, we decide that we're going to double down an investment on education, particularly in STEM and technology, and more sort of strategic thinking and the ability to reason. If we do that, then we can really be on the forefront of this kind of wave of change. It's interesting because I think that there really is so much debate about whether or not artificial intelligence or machine learning is going to improve or going to create more jobs or have a negative impact. I think that the Pew study that was out in 2014 surveyed a wide range of AI professionals, and they were split 50-50 on whether or not it was going to be beneficial for job creation or negative. So we just don't know. But if you know that there's something on the horizon, and you know that what you need is investment in human capital to be able to make it come to fruition, that is where you're going to see the differentiation. And it's not necessarily Western countries or the United States that's going to be on the forefront of this. It's going to be those countries who decide they're going to invest in those and their people and in education and being able to take advantage of the real potential and opportunity that artificial intelligence and machine learning provides.
All right, and that's all we have time for. I'd like to thank our panelists today for coming out and talking to us.
Thank you.